It is not easy to monetize edtech in Pakistan. Startups are competing with free content on YouTube. However, my guest on this episode of the Misal Podcast has successfully monetized his edtech startup and built the go-to place for A-levels prep. His name is Asad Hashim Ali, and he's the co-founder of Alt Academy. Alt Academy makes A-levels prep a piece of cake. You get access to 9 expert-led courses for one low subscription. Let's listen in. Welcome to the Misal Podcast, Asad. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me, Zahid.
Thank you for joining me today. This is the first time I'm talking to a founder who's also a podcaster. So really excited to have you on and learn what you're building as well as, you know, your journey in terms of podcasting. So let's get started with a quick introduction. Please tell me a little bit about yourself and what is the problem that you're trying to solve with Alt Academy?
I am, just like many of us, very confused in these times, trying to figure out what to do and how to navigate these rough waters. But we are building Alt Academy, and that's not just a business aim, but that's also a personal aim as well. Alt Academy is designed to transform high school level education, and particularly with the A levels right now. Our goal is to digitize and then really transform that learning experience and making sure that we're not just building, we're not just giving access to high quality and affordable content to students, but we're also able to really help them mold into better versions of themselves and equip them with the skills that are necessary to navigate the world ahead.
What exactly made you start something like a test prep? Was there a personal story involved, or was there some just desire, you know, to help people or students, and you were like, you know what, this is how I can contribute?
Yeah, no, definitely. So when in 2019, my business partner and founder, Bilal Hamid, and I, along with a couple other people, we were just sitting and we were thinking about, you know, what's going wrong with the school system today? And this is pre-COVID. And we had this experience of setting up prior A-level schools and operating A-level schools as well. And every time, with every new school that we would do, we realized that there were always certain kinks in the system. And the systems also weren't everlasting. But most importantly, the format of teaching wasn't evolving. There was no innovation happening over there. And we thought that, you know, if we could actually compress the time required to give instruction in class and free up time for children and students to explore other avenues, areas of interest that they might have, you know, explore the 4 C's that are required for the 21st century. So creativity, collaboration, critical thinking, and communication. What could they do? And that's what led us to venture on into actually trying to digitize our own course material for the A-level prep. Because the goal was, and the goal still is, solve for the A-level prep so that you have time to do anything and everything beyond that. School isn't just about going to class and sitting for your exam. School is about engaging. School is about learning. It's about growing. It's about socializing. And you need those options available. Now, if schools are spending all the time teaching, they're also not providing the facilities that are required to do everything else that goes around education.
What do you feel when you talk to people, you know, you tell them like, oh, I'm running a startup and it's about, you know, it's in ed tech and all that stuff? Is, I know it's not sexy. So is there a point where like you get like pushback in terms of like, you know, why are you doing this? And like, you know, who will pay for this and stuff like that?
So I think because we started off early on, so I think it's important to note also that we started the working on this in 2019 under the name of Alt Academy. But Bilal had been working on this for years prior to 2019 as well, under his own name. He started off with YouTube. Some of our other friends who are working with us on this also were creating their own content, hoping that it's just going to help their own students. But you put it up on YouTube to see what the scale is going to be like and, you know, who else might need it. And then as COVID passed, in COVID, we didn't do much with Alt Academy. We just let it sit and we let it accrue all these users and students on board. And it's completely free. But then in 2021, we decided to actually launch this formally, because by that time, we realized that there's this sense of stickiness with online studying. And we thought that, you know, what would work for us is that if we put this in a subscription model, because some things did allow line for us, which was that the economy was going downhill, and not just in Pakistan, but globally. The need for high quality education at a price point that parents and students can afford was very important. And also, because of COVID and all the YouTube content that we had going out, students from all around the world were already starting to know about Bilal and the other teachers that we have on the platform. And that kind of led to this mass of students coming in. So we realized that there is this need, there is this desire. Now students anywhere in the world, even today, don't feel the need to go to their local tuition teacher or go to school. They could also just find some resource online and study from them. Because for them, what matters is getting access to that content. And that's when we realized that, okay, you know, if we stick to what we want to do, and this is what we really want to do, we can change that. And as for the perception of people, I think because of what Baijiu's did, automatically everything in edtech became very sexy. The unfortunate factor of comparing us to Baijiu is that, well, Baijiu's not doing so well on paper, right? Their whole audit report came out, and I don't know what's going on over there. But what I do know is that we have a lot of lessons to learn from, and we have case studies now available to us. With the whole rise of edtech in India especially, I think other edtechs can be very mindful of and can learn from that of what not to do and what you can do as well. And of course, you tinker based on your own context and you gauge your own market. At the end of the day, you have to take that risk.
There are a lot of, I think, startups that are working in that tech space in Pakistan. There are very few startups that are funded. What's the landscape like when it comes to edtech in Pakistan? Like, what are some of the main players that you find yourself competing with?
That's a very interesting question, because when we even think about this, who do we compare ourselves to? We don't really, on our positioning framework, we don't really look at the local startups, not because, you know, we don't consider them as competition, but it's because we can start breaking them down into niches. As I said, we're in A-levels. So we are catering to a whole, we're catering to a very different student body and a very different count of students as well, compared to the Maksats and the Edcasas and the Outclasses as well. The Outclass, I would say, is a competitor for us, but that's also if we look at it from a grade level below when they go into O-levels. So O-levels would be grade 9, 10, 11, and then A-levels is 12 and 13. Two very exam formats, two very different exam formats, two very different syllabi. And of course, the prep that's required for them is very different. We haven't really come across competitors that are coming into the A-level space only because of the years of experience you need to teach that. And then the finding that the right resources as well. Resources for A-levels are very expensive. Coming back to comparison of other startups, every other startup is doing phenomenal work. Right, you have Edcasa that's doing amazing. You have Maksat that's doing amazing. Nearpeer is killing it, right, with the test prep and with college admissions tests as well. But they're not directly in our space. We do have a lot to learn from them when it comes to actually marketing, when it comes to sales, when it comes to product. But at this moment, we don't really see them as competitors, only because we're just focused on staying in our lane. Once we decide to switch over the lanes is when they might start becoming competitors.
Is there something about test prep that you initially thought before, you know, starting Alt Academy, and then once you started it, you realized like there was something that was amiss, like you figured it out after you started?
So what I realized actually was that compared to my time in A-levels, and I did my A-levels in 2014, and now when I see students giving their A-levels now, the level of anxiety and stress that's going around their exam prep is very different from how it was in my time. Yeah, I personally did freak out for my exams. I used to work really hard and study for them. And we have those personal anecdotes too. But today, I feel like the challenges that students face are very different from the challenges that we faced, right? And that's just purely because of the evolution of technology and social media that's around them as well. All the stimulus that comes their way, it's not a matter of giving them that secret sauce or helping them crack the exam, but it's also a matter of helping them realize that that grade is just a grade to help them get to the next step. It's not a reflection of themselves. It's not a reflection of their performance. It's just a standardized tool to help you decide which university you can go to or you should go to, or that the university is basically using as a guard to let you in. So what we're trying to do is we're also trying to change this mindset around the grades itself and test prep itself. You know, our interest is, yeah, today we're solving for exam prep, 100%. But our goal, our vision, our mission is far beyond test prep.
You mentioned something interesting, which I personally have also observed. Kids or students that I, you know, speak to right now, their focus or they tend to have a lot of anxiety about things, and in general. And I personally, I feel like that's because there's so much more information out there. And for them, it's like kind of fear of missing out on like, okay, what if we also knew this, then we could ace the test and stuff like that. So that's very interesting that you point out.
One point over here, actually, I want to add in, right? Let's take this, like, let's actually try breaking this down in the life of a even 14, 15 year old. Someone, a child that's not giving their A-levels or O-levels right now. They're still in probably grade 8 or 9. Sitting in Pakistan, you don't get Prime, right? That energy drink. But that 13, 14-year-old has access to all the content from all around the world, and Logan Paul as well. And now whenever he or she decides to travel, wants to just get their hands on that bottle of Prime. And there's that element as well. What you said, FOMO, that applies to not just having access to the people around you or having access to your friend circle's inner lives, but it's also about being involved with other people's lives and being part of other cultures and trends that are happening all around the world. So it's all of this that's happening in one split second, right? That it's kind of time for us to also kind of help students realize that they can slow down the pace, but also they can ramp up the pace, but they have to be able to be, they have to be equipped with the right tools to make that decision.
Yeah. I mean, culturally speaking, like YouTube kind of has taken over kind of the teaching aspect of a lot of things. People just, you know, if it's a tutorial, if it's some sort of a skill or some sort of like a subject or topic that they want to learn, it's of course video-based learning. Anything visual is very easy to learn on YouTube. So that's how people get influenced. And it's like, you know, like I said, it's like information is coming from all different directions. And it's like what you pick on, what you act on is very different than what the information we had back, you know, when at least when I'm talking about like late 90s for myself. And there was one person you could go to and talk to, be like, hey, what are my options here? They'd be like, oh, aapne metric pass kiya, you do this, aapne ye kiya, so you do this. It was like very simple, like two or three pathways to, you know, university. But yeah, I mean, I totally understand all that. But let me ask you this. So you mentioned that, you know, your co-founder, Bilal, he taught, you know, classes and also teaches now. Who else is teaching for you? Like, what is that process like? How do you vet your instructors?
So we are not a marketplace, right? I think that's very important to highlight. We have handpicked all of our instructional designers based on two key factors, their teaching style and their relationship with us. Now, the reason why I say the relationship with us matters over here as a vetting process is because that means that they have that shared understanding and that shared vision as well, that the education space, especially in the A-levels, really has to change. Right. And once we can solve this problem, we can move on to so many other problems to solve and so many other examination boards as well. It just becomes a matter of being able to map and solve and find the gaps and then adjust the product accordingly. Right. And that's basically the two key factors when it comes to vetting these instructional designers. These teachers have been with us from school. So Bilal started off his career in 2002. He used to teach in multiple schools and used to drive around giving tuitions at people's houses. And then in 2008, he was one of the founders of this college called Nixer. So Rushan, who came on your podcast as well, was Bilal's student once upon a time. And then in 2015, Bilal was one of the founders of Cedar College, which has around like four or five campuses all around the city. It's who we've met along the years. And that's where, by the way, I met Bilal as well. So I was an intern for Bilal, and then eventually we became buddies and now partners. But over the years, it's who we've met that have that shared vision for changing the way they even instruct in class. And of course, they have the decades of experience of in-class experience, one-on-one experience, and then they're also staying abreast with all the research and the best practices that's required to teach online. Teaching online is not the same as providing a lecture. Right. So that's where we work with them very closely to make sure that delivery for the online platform is A1. It's solid.
You mentioning subscription, because you said it was free, then you moved on to subscription. Building a SaaS product in Pakistan, it's not that straightforward. And so can you touch on that? Like, how did you make that decision as to like, okay, people will pay for something recurring every single month, versus like people will just pay for one course or one time?
So I think it's very important to also keep in mind that just like any great product that you know, pulls in retention and engagement and stickiness and all of that fun stuff, is designed by keeping in mind the customer journey. An average student, or students in general, let's not generalize this, but students will have this behavior pattern of going to school and then from school going to tuitions. Now, when they go to tuitions, they're not shopping for tutors throughout the year. They'll find one tutor, maybe two tutors for a given subject. And then by the second month, they would have shortlisted who they want to study from for the rest of the academic year. And then they'll stick by them. But that is also happening there. Now, their payment is also happening on a month-by-month basis. Now, in A-level, students also have three subjects, maximum four or five subjects that they have to give. And that often becomes a combination as well. So if you know that you want to go into computer science, or if you want to go into engineering, you're going to study the sciences. If you want to study economics, then you're going to focus on the social sciences or on the humanities side of things as well. And you have these certain subject combinations. And you also have students that decide like, okay, let's just mix all of this up. Let's do a combination of psychology, accounts, and art. just for fun, because they also just want to go to a liberal arts college eventually. The fact that they are finding tutors, or that they are also, you know, having to pay a monthly fee to any for any extra help, kind of dictates that, okay, if you were to digitize this, give everything in one offering, there could be this behavior pattern for them to pay on a recurring basis. And interestingly, for us, we don't just have students paying on a monthly basis and you have a monthly MRR. We also have a quarterly and an annual package as well, which actually has some of the best results. So a bulk of our students actually have subscribed for our quarterly packages. And then you have the annual and then you have the monthly. And of course, it depends on what point in time in the academic journey a student decides to opt in. But on average, what we've seen is that students are coming on for around 5.5-6 months with us.
Okay, so yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question as to like how long the process is for them in terms of like how long does it take for them to complete A-levels and stuff like that. Okay, so it's like a 6 months process. And is there what I usually see with SaaS products is like they're always trying to add more and more features. And now that AI is like, you know, everywhere and everyone's talking about it, everyone's looking into it, has there been a point where people have been like, hey, do you have like an AI chatbot that I can talk to so that I don't have to talk to an instructor, or some really weird feature request like that? Have you had that? And in general, how do you see AI changing how you build your next features?
I think when this question gets asked, and when I've also spoken to others in the same space, we tend to have this mindset that let's rush towards this new phenomenon in the world, and let's see how it can help us, and let's see what we can do. And it's cool and it's sexy and it's all of those things as well. But then you have to look inside your own data, and you have to ask the hard question that, is this really going to accelerate my work? Is this really helpful? And how early are we to adopt such technology, or how late are we to adopt such technology? Now, yes, of course, there are a lot of processes that can be made efficient. There's a lot of design work that can be done with the help of AI. But when we talk to our students, when we talk to our parent body, what they also want is that connection with people as well, right? Which right now we haven't come across such a tool which can be digitized or which could be scaled through AI. Yes, there are tools and we are experimenting. I'm not going to say that we're not experimenting with it, but we haven't really launched any feature that involves the use of AI like what Khan Migo is doing. But we are working on that. But after doing collecting a lot of insights from parents actually have this trust factor, knowing that there are humans on the other end. And they're fine with the lag in response time, as long as there's someone with experience, right? And someone who understands the need of their child on the platform.
I personally also prefer someone, you know, teaching me something in person, especially I'm a mostly visual learner and I like to talk to people. So I've used, of course, ChatGPT to ask basic questions, learn something new, but still at the end of the day, it's like you are always, you know, not sure about like what it's saying, because it's very delusional and it can make things up. So, I mean, that I definitely understand that part, where like the personal touch as well as like someone really understanding what you're going through at the time, improvising to cater to that situation and delivering the, you know, the product to you in a way that works out for you. So I don't think there's any tool.
But you have to balance it out, right? I think that, you know, on a design level, you have to balance that out. AI can be a tool. It can also be what ends your game. At the end of the day, what's very important for us also is to keep talking to our own students and understand what are the subtle nuances that they need. You know, how can we help them better? And if maybe it is some form of human connection that's going to help them better and navigate their A-level journey better, then I don't know how AI would help over there. Even for academic support, one of our features is academic support. We have a team of individuals that are actually there, right? These are not just university students. These are, you know, graduates with a couple of years of experience in class that are working with us to make sure that every single answer is on point. We're also still growing, right? This is actually, we're now entering one full buying cycle for us. So for context, the A-levels exams happen thrice a year. So there's the October-November session, there's the Feb-March session, which happens in India, and then there's the May-June session. Last in 2021, when we launched officially, we started monetization in 2022, October 22. We have just closed our first financially viable academic year. Now we're moving on to our second one. There's so much for us to do, right? There's so many things that we have to solve for. At the point in time we are right now, I think it makes business sense for us to just keep our attention towards acquisition, right? It's a time for survival as well for businesses. So the whole rise in AI can also be a distraction as well, I feel. Yes, you keep experimentation there. You have your design and your innovation working on the side. And you have to figure out what business sense does it make to incorporate that, and how is it going to help the product itself, and how is it going to help the users? And then in return, how is it going to contribute to revenue? And that's where we're just constantly working on that spiral.
What in terms of new features and services can we expect from you? Like, are you planning to bring in like MCATs and all that other test prep in the future, or are you just sticking to one thing and focusing on that?
So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to really form Alt Academy into an online high school. Give it that whole look and feel of an online high school. And we have that flavor going on. MCAT, no, we're not working on college test prep just yet. There are some developments happening. They are in the works, which I'm not going to share at this moment. But something that actually might be of interest to you is actually our guidance module. So guidance at Alt Academy is basically a separate wing or a separate arm that focuses on college and academic counseling for students. And the idea is that to scale this up onto a one-to-many format where students get that... They get help with forming study plans. They get help with navigating which universities to apply to, what would be the right career choice, you know, dealing with exam stress and anxiety, navigating the balance between extracurriculars and school life, you know. So that's what we're working on. And that's something that we're doing to kind of improve the learner experience. And that's, I think, one of the big, that's our sole effort right now when it comes to new development. Of course, cleaning up some of the content that we have, adding on new subjects that's happening. We just launched computer science. We have biology and psychology coming out very soon too. Yeah, that's actually not just one thing. There are many things that are happening. My bad, but yeah.
During the introduction, I mentioned that you also do podcasting. So I want to touch on that topic, do a little bit with you. What made you decide to start a podcast, and how's the journey been so far?
Okay, that's a very... I was never prepared for this kind of question. So I think what got me to start this podcast was when I used to work at Cedar. I started off with... I was an intern, and then after graduating from university, Bilal gave me a job offer to be the head of digital media and communications over there. So we were just creating content left, right, and center, and changing the way A-level schools even talk to students in the first place. And one of the ideas I had was to create a podcast, and that podcast was called Listen Up. We ran it for 3 seasons, and I think now Cedar is still going on with it, but sporadically. And after I left Cedar, I was like, you know, man, I made this podcast, and it was so great. Like, I love doing it. I always wanted to be an actor once upon a time. So why not just, you know, create more content for myself? But the idea, and that's what I want to underline, for myself. So I came up with Behind the Grind because I thought that it's a good opportunity for me to document my own personal journey and document my own learnings over the years. So that one fine day when I look back in time, I'd be able to see, and I would be the only one who could judge, okay, and this at this point in time, this was happening in Asad's life. This is how he was thinking. This is how he was working. This is the issues that he had. These are the struggles he had. And this is how he's evolved. And at every point in time, I started Behind the Grind in 2018. I look at you and I'm like, wow, you know, you've got like over 50, 60 episodes and I'm still on 35, 36. And it, of course, it does annoy me that, you know, there's so many big podcasters around now that started after me, but they have such a big following, but I'm not chasing the following. I'm trying to document my own journey too. So at every point where I start and stop, it's kind of a reflection of myself at that point in time. Because I have that creative bug as well. I want to speak, but I also want to hear stories. You know, when I started my first company, Backspace, I tell people that Backspace was like the MBA for me. Learning how to do business in real time. You know, discovering, I come from a family of traders, you know, so Jodia Bazaar style means that char line khicho dekho kitna aa raha hai kitna ja raha hai. So I implemented that in a consultancy firm. But doing the podcast was me like getting real life case studies to supplement my work as well. And that's still happening.
Part creativity, part personal, like professional development for you in terms of like, you know, talking to people. Has it helped you in any way in working at or building Alt Academy?
I think so. Yeah. Because interestingly enough, there's one episode in particular that I keep going back to. And that was with Zain Omar. Zain is, he works at Credit Book in their fintech arm. One of the early starters at Credit Book. And interestingly enough, he too was Bilal's student once upon a time. So Zain came on the podcast and we were talking about like you know, creating savings products. And this is when the economy was just starting to pop and Startup Dan was just popping. Airlift had just crashed recently. And he said something about founder product fit or founder market fit. And that really stuck. And then there was an episode with Vladimira Briestinska. She's the founder of Neem. And talking about financial inclusion, that really got me to think about a lot of ideas that we can do in the future also. So in a way, if it even hasn't helped me directly in the business, I know that it's helping me build relationships for future opportunities. And it's also opening many options, many doors for me too. I had Shahzad Jeeva, who's the CEO of the Aga Khan University Examination Board. And when I sit with him, now I could say like, you know, he's we're on very good terms. So I hear how his students are growing. I hear how they're implementing project-based learning. And it gives you this exposure to a whole other side. And there's such great work that's happening within the country that just hearing about kind of inspires you. And then, you know, you can take inspiration from that and implement that into your own work as well.
So, I mean, I was going to follow up with a question about like, are there any conversations that you really are memorable to you and stuff, but you already answered that. So that's great. So I'll move on. No. That's fine. I'll just go on to my next question, which was about like, so, I mean, podcasting, of course, it's a conversation that you're recording, but there is a lot that happens in the background, right? What is that process been like for you? Have you struggled with it, or did you have any help in terms of setting up your studio, mics, you know, all those other things that go on with? And is that the reason you're not putting out as many episodes? Because logistically, it's not as easy for me. I mean, at least for me, it's like, you know, just a online conversation in a way. And for you, it's like, you know, you have to make sure the guest is available, figure out like how will they get to the studio and all those other things. For me, that's not the case. So was that the reason like you kind of slowed down?
So the logistical side of things, I tend to record in the office only. So it's not like I've made a separate studio. It's not like it's a sacred space that I have. I have never really been so particular in making sure that the angles are set, the lighting is perfect. For me, it's just the audio, right? Because I'm a very audio first guy. Like on the way over here, I listen to podcasts all the time, but I listen. That's the thing. Now podcasting has become a very YouTube first approach. And I'm still an old school with this. So of course I put out content on YouTube, and that's not the logistic. That's not the obstacle for me. I feel like it's my own schedule that becomes the obstacle for me. At every single point in time, something or the other has come up with work, you know, and I try to forgive myself if I haven't recorded or if I haven't been consistent. But what I've done now, like over the past 2 weeks, I've managed to record 4 episodes and they're just in the backlog. I haven't released them because now what I want to do is I want to change up the distribution of that content as well. So I have my own ideas too. It's just that, you know, there's not enough time to execute on those ideas. And I have one guy, I have this friend of mine who used to work with me at my old company. He helps me shoot and record and edit and does all of those things as well. It's just a matter of like, you know, you are your biggest enemy. I am my biggest enemy. My schedule is my biggest enemy. And I don't want to burn out because I've had those moments as well that I've been recording constantly and I've been editing myself and I've been working. COVID was exactly like that for me. Was working 18, 20 hours a day. And usme, I was also running. I was also exercising and sleeping 4 or 5 hours. And it just took a lot out of me. So I want to make sure that I can do this at a sustainable pace. The bigger question is also that why does this matter? Why does the frequency matter? Why does the operations of all of this matter? It only matters to me. And that's how I have to keep moving forward with this. It's not like I have people waiting for me. I have people that ask me, why haven't you released an episode? But what's more important is that, am I in the right headspace to do this? Because I have to put my best version out. People are going to spend an hour, hour and a half listening to my content. And even if I'm speaking for 25% of the time, it better be one of the best pieces of content that they have heard because they just gave me an hour of their time.
Yeah, you kind of talked about pretty much everything in terms of like the journey that, you know, any creative person takes. And there is a lot of, you know, self-doubt and like you're trying to figure out if things are going to be good and all those things where you want to put out a product that you can go look back a few years from now and be like, okay, I'm proud of this. And I think that's what we all struggle with. And there was a time when I almost quit. And
really?
I almost quit. And this was like, you know, 30, 40 episodes ago. And I was like, okay, no one is watching it. No one cares. What am I doing? This takes a lot of time and all those things. So then I convinced myself and I spoke to someone who also is in the ecosystem and stuff. And he kind of said, you know what, like, don't force yourself. Just put out one episode a month, one episode every 2 months, if that's what you want to do. So I did that. So I went from like recording like almost every single week, every single weekend, to recording once or twice a month, which is what the frequency is right now. I'm just trying to put out like a couple of episodes, and I'm trying to make sure that those two episodes like are put a lot of effort and making sure they're as good as I wanted them to be. And so, yeah, so focusing on the advice, like you said, YouTube first podcast is a Pakistani phenomenon. Mostly all over the world, it's listened through audio and Apple Podcasts, Spotify. That's where people listen. That's where I listen to my podcast too. So for me, it was like, okay, there's this huge effort that I'm putting into YouTube because that's where the audience is. And if I don't do that, I am not going to be finding any kind of audience for my creative craft. So that's the reason I went towards that. Otherwise, if this was not like a video thing, I would be able to talk to a lot more people and be able to get out a lot more podcasts more frequently. But then again, it's like everyone has to do things based on what they want to do and they should be doing and all those other things that, you know, come in between.
No, 100%. And I think at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's as you mentioned, it's, you said, you know, once a month or once every 2 months, if that's what you have to do to keep going. That's why when I take a break and people ask me, someone last weekend actually asked me that, have you stopped? Have you quit? I was like, I never said I quit. And if I adopt that mindset that, ha, ab to meri bus ho gayi, I'm just going to stop this now, then you also want to go at a high. So if you remind yourself that, you know, it's just a break and I will eventually get back to it, you'll also just be a lot kinder on yourself also to get back into it, but get back to it with a lot more spunk and energy as well. And then, you know, you just want to kick ass with it as well and grow this even further. Because it's not about the numbers. I really feel it's about the quality of the conversation. And that dictates how big it becomes.
To the person that I spoke to who told me like, you know, I should keep going, asked me if I'm enjoying the process. Like, am I, you know, the conversations, the process. I said, yeah, I do enjoy the process. It's not that I hate it and I'm doing it just for like clicks and views and stuff. So that's one of the things that I was like, okay, then let's keep doing it, not as frequently, because that would be burning me out.
I just end up, it, you know, just to add in, sorry, one point over there, because you asked me my process and what's my challenge. I don't like going into the conversation unprepared, right? Like you also did your research. I saw that on the invitation you asked for my LinkedIn. And before this, we had that little jamming session just to get to know each other a little bit as well. But I tend to spend maybe a couple of hours on just the questions itself. And I pass that on to the guest. And I've been fortunate enough to actually get a very positive response from the guests recently, because they're like, okay, it seems like you're really thinking about what you want to ask and how critical you are of asking these questions too. Very recently I had Salman Parekh. He started the brand Monto, and I gave him the questions. He came to the office right before we were going to shoot, and we spent an hour just going over the questions and him trying to understand my intention and me understanding his background. And that tango is very important also. And I think that, you know, when people see podcasts, they think it's literally just a matter of putting up a mic, turning the camera on and just start talking. But it's not that. It's everything that happens before that.
I of course can't name people, but there are a few people who have been on this podcast. I guess I have released enough podcasts that I can mention this now, that they have been on the podcast. They are running startups and they were very serious about starting a podcast. They're like, you know, what's the process like? I want to do it virtually too. How much do you pay? And all the logistics, you know, they had me like tell them about it and all those things. And nothing happened. And so they were not able to, you know, publish or maybe record it. I don't know. But like, yeah, they dropped the ball somehow. And for me, it's like, I understand that because it makes sense to you when you watch it on YouTube, like, oh, it's a 30-minute conversation. Like, how difficult can this be, right? But when you start looking into what you need to do to get to that 30-minute conversation, there's a lot of work. And unless you are cut out for it, unless like, you know, you can keep doing it without any feedback, without any appreciation for like a really long time, like that is, you know, they say, right, kutta hona padta hai. So that's basically it. Like you really have to just do it because you want to do it and not because, you know, you will be appreciated or stuff like that. We have seen like more recently with, you know, Meds and More and Jugnu, the startup ecosystem is going through a lot of turmoil in terms of funding also now shutting, you know, startups shutting down. What are your thoughts and what do you feel about that aspect of the startup ecosystem?
Unfortunately, I might not be the best person to answer this because we're not a VC-backed startup. We were bootstrapped for a while. We raised a little round as well. So I personally have just been staying in tune with announcements and what's happening in this space. But I think what's more important is that what we don't realize is that whether it's a startup or it's a PE business, whatever it is, businesses start and stop, right? It's unfortunate, it's sad, and there's a lot of commentary around what they did wrong and, you know, what they did right. But I feel like that's on nobody to comment but the founders of the business. It's sad. A business shutting down is not pleasant. It's not fun. But this is also part of the cycle, right? Smooth waters never made a good sailor. It's literally that. So if startups now see that, you know, valuations are going down, if businesses are flopping, use that as an opportunity to learn about what you should avoid and what you cannot do. But then also give the founders a little break as well, because it's not easy burning all that money and losing all that money. It's not fun seeing that you have to shut down altogether and whatever you choose to do after that, right? But it's also very important to remember that they had raised money over a period of time at different valuations, at different dollar values also. So there's one frame of reference which you can have is that, oh, $22 million vanished. But the other is that years of hard work just didn't prove that concept. And that's A-okay, because now you know what can work and what cannot work. And if you were to restart this, then you have a lot more. You have many lessons to learn from also over here.
Of course, I have very strong opinions about all this too. But one thing is like, okay, the 22 million actually did end up in the, you know, Pakistani economy in a way. They hired people, they invested in inventory, they got warehouses and all that stuff. So there is that. Plus, like, I think people really need to now understand that a startup that is successful is actually an exception.
Yeah.
Normally, startup is supposed to fail. Startups being successful is actually an exception. But I think people have it completely reversed, where startup failing is like, you know, they take personal insult. It's like, aapka kya bigada tha? Like, what happened to you that you're so butthurt that you have to be out there and, like, you know, saying the things that you're saying, which is automatically, it's like, it's a scam, it's a fraud, regulate them. It's like, well, do you know it's a scam? Do you know it's a fraud? Do you know if the regulations would fix something like this? No one has those answers, but...
And I think, you know, look, exactly what you said. Do you know it's a scam? Do you know it's fraud? Regulate them. There's only beef around this area. And there's only, the only reason why it becomes such a hot topic is because it's online and you get this news online. Now, if I just was to replace the word startup with business, and I was to say, instead of saying Jugnu, I was to say distributor, and instead of me saying $22 million, I was to say 100 crore rupees, your frame of reference changes altogether, right? Go inside Korangi, Landi area, go towards Bolton Market. You have businesses happening at such a large scale, right? That are probably doing like around 1 crore rupees a day, 2 crore rupees a day, and just turnover as well. And those businesses flop left, right, and center. And we tend to forget that this is normal, right? Like, we only are affected because it's happening online and it's the cool new thing. But a startup is just like any other business. A business also has to raise a round of financing. They just call it investment, or they call it revenue share or profit share, whatever it is. The terms are different. But that can also shut down, and this can also shut down. And they happen every day, in good times and in bad times. Especially in bad times, it hits more, but they also happen in good times as well.
Well, thank you so much for being on the Misal podcast, talking about Alt Academy, as well as, you know, sharing your journey with podcasting. It was great having you here. Wish you all the best in the future, and hopefully we'll have you again sometime in the future and talk more about both the topics of building a startup as well as podcasting.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. This was fun. It's the first thing in the morning for me, so I'm glad this is what started my day off. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Misal podcast. I hope you enjoyed the podcast and will thank me by writing a review or sharing it on social media. Make sure you follow and subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Thanks again. See you soon.